The Pat Kenny Show
with MasterCard. Share an extraordinary experiences all over the world with priceless cities at priceless.com.
This is News Talk.
We begin this morning with one of the most influential political voices of the last two decades. My next guest was a senator in Massachusetts for 28 years, from 1985 until 2013. He was the Democratic Party's nominee for U.S. presidency in 2004. But it is perhaps his work since then which will leave the most indelible mark on the history books, from the Iran deal to the Paris Climate Accord. As the United States Secretary of State under President Barack Obama, John Kerry was in the room for some of the most important conversations of recent years. His story is a little different to most politicians, including serving in the Vietnam War, from which he emerged highly decorated, but also deeply skeptical of that conflict. From finding himself on a yacht with JFK as a teenager to introducing John Lennon at an anti-war rally in New York City, and on to decades in politics, John Kerry's new autobiography, Every Day is Extra, tells the story of a quite remarkable life. And he joins me on the line now. John Kerry, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure talking to you on a very momentous day in London, as it happens.
You've touched on my Forrest Gumpian life a little bit.
You're wherever disaster happens, John Kerry is not far behind. Actually,
well,
it's
being
triumph.
On a yacht with President Kennedy was not a disaster, but other than that.
Well, some of the things that you have been involved in, the Iran deal and also the Paris Climate Accord, we'll talk about in a moment. We should reflect, though, first of all, on the little clip we played from a recent interview you gave about the Donald Trump not really, as I would understand it, being fit to be president of the United States.
Well, that statement does not come from me. It comes from countless numbers of people who have been quoted now in many different articles, as well as in two books, the book by Bob Woodward and the book by Michael Wolff. Both made it very clear that this is a chaotic, unprecedentedly disorganized and not particularly effective administration that is really breaking a lot of china, I guess, is the way to say it. I think it's unfortunate. I mean, it's, you know, there are very legitimate reasons that he was elected, and there are very legitimate fears and anxieties in the voters everywhere in the world today. So it's not as if, you know, it's built completely on a house of sand or something. It's really serious political transformation taking place on a global basis, which needs to be focused on everywhere. I mean, obviously, you've just mentioned, you know, Brexit and what's happening in Britain and Europe. But you have other currents in Europe. You have Italy, you have La Lega, you have Salvini, you have this, you have Orban, and you have Hungary. Discontent, clearly, even in Germany, that's been expressed in recent elections. So what I think you have is a global level of skepticism about governance generally, and it's legitimate because governance is not getting the job done. You have too much corruption in too many places. You have gridlock or you know, challenges to reasonableness in terms of compromise and extremes on both sides tugging at everybody. So this is a moment for calm. It's a moment for leadership. It's a moment to understand why, for the period we just celebrated, the memory of World War I and its conclusion. World War II, of course, was the unfinished business of World War I, and then you had the Cold War, which was the unfinished business of World War II. So we've had a last century defined by conflict and competition, and we're at the dawn of the 21st century with an opportunity to write a different history. And I hope we will, but it takes leadership to do it.
The lack of competences in the president, you talk about, you know, not understanding the principle of the separation of powers, the mercurial attitude to even someone like Jim Acosta in the White House, and we'll be talking about that later on in the program, going to court against John Kelly and the president and pretty much everybody involved in that whole saga. It's not quite unprecedented, but in this era, it's very unusual.
Well, it's more than just unusual, I think, Pat. I think it's very destructive to democracy itself in the end. I mean, if you are constantly attacking elections without evidence, raising a hue and cry about their legitimacy, if you are challenging the election process without evidence and simply saying it's fixed or it's illegitimate or they're trying to steal an election, they're not trying to steal an election, they're trying to make sure every vote is counted. The fact is, there's only one party in America that works overtime to find ways to prevent people from voting. And everybody knows that. It's documented in laws that get passed, in all kinds of measures that are taken. I saw it in my race for the presidency in Ohio in 2004, and we've seen it as recently as now in Georgia and in Florida and places. You know, for some reason, where there's a Republican Secretary of State who's got responsibility for administering an election, inevitably you have a lot of machines in the Republican precincts and you have very few in the Democrats. And they wind up waiting longer. I think that's frankly fundamentally unconstitutional in terms of due process and equal protection under the law. But it's, you know, I think we've got to make our democracies work all around the world. If you go back in history, the end of World War I, there were about 20 democracies in the world where people were fully free, and then it went up and then it went down again right before World War II, 1939. And then afterwards, we saw this burst of energy to try to embrace a different set of values and rules-based order for global behavior, with the creation of the United Nations, with the rules of trade and so forth. And during that time, we went up to about 88 democracies that are fully free, with another 59 or so that were partially free. And then you only had something like 44 countries or so that were not free. Now there's been a trend in the last few years for people to re-embrace this populist authoritarianism, which some people fear could even breed fascism at some point in time. So we have real things to be talking about, and not, frankly, I mean, I wish not the president's behavior, as we saw in Paris in the last few days. An almost childish truculence that was really inexplicable. We have big issues like climate change, where the president has pulled out of the climate change agreement. I mean, we're seeing the effects of that in fires in California. And some people try to avoid that reality, but the fact is there have been droughts. There have been an increase because of the nature of storms now in the brush that grows very quickly and then burns, has the ability to burn. So there's more fuel for the fire as a result of this cycle we're now in. And I think if you measure the last three storms we had in the United States last year, cost us $265 billion to clean up after them. But we don't even fund the $100 billion. That was supposed to go to the Green Climate Fund to help countries that don't have money to be able to develop energy that's sustainable. So we're not making wise choices on a global basis.
Here's the rub. You talk about democracy and the number of democracies which has grown and then fallen and then grown again. Recently, I saw a stat that suggested that the freest democracy in the Middle East and in the Arab world is Tunisia, and that's imperfect in itself. But the problem with democracy is that sometimes the people we don't like get a popular mandate. The people wrong-headed policies get a popular mandate.
But you see, Pat, I don't think when you say the problem with it is this is what happens, I would disagree with that proposition. It's the inevitability of what happens if government isn't responding adequately to people's needs. You don't have right-wing, or nativist, nationalist movements unless something's happening to the contrary. I think the immigration issue, writ large in the world, has not been addressed properly. I mean, we have upwards of 12 million, and many people assert more, illegal immigrants in the United States, and that is not one party's fault. Every presidency of the last 20 years has not done what was necessary to guarantee the enforcement of sovereignty, the enforcement of borders, the meaning of visas, and so forth. Europe's experienced that. I mean, Europe had this massive invasion that came from the chaos of Syria and from Turkey and so forth. And Angela Merkel made a courageous but obviously a difficult political decision to let 1 million people into Germany, and it's had a profound impact on changing the politics of Germany. So we have to be smart about how we deal with the realities of these issues. Borders have to mean something. Nations' sovereignty means something. And you're seeing a reaction to the fact that whatever party or whoever was in power simply wasn't responding to these things in a particularly adroit and competent way.
I want to go back in time, John, if I may, to your own formation. I mentioned in my introduction that you served in the Vietnam War on a short tour. You felt lucky to get out of there alive. I remember I was a student at Georgia Tech at the time of the Vietnam War. And, you know, so many guys were in the ROTC program, which kept them out of Vietnam temporarily. But many of them were going to go to Vietnam. And if you remember, that's that hit 19, about the average age of those who died was 19 in Vietnam. And equally, if you were a first lieutenant going to Vietnam, your life expectancy was 3 weeks. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible time.
Well, it was a terrible time, Pat. There's no question about that. We were lied to by our government, and that is now fully documented in many books. One of the best of all was Neil Sheehan's brilliant book, Bright Shining Lie, which really tells the story in a highly documented and very poignant way. But I think that what's important to, I write about it in my book. I mean, in the book, I detail sort of that period of time, my service in Vietnam, coming back home, my struggle against the war, along with a lot of other veterans, and the whole anti-war movement, environment effort, peace, and women's movement. There was just a massive engagement of young people during the late 1960s and 70s. And the point to be made out of all of that is it was a terrible time, but we made it through and became stronger because of it. I mean, if you look back at that period, 1968, there was really a semi-revolution among students and campuses around the country. Campuses literally didn't hold exams in the spring. Classes were canceled. A remarkable period of upheaval. Martin Luther King was assassinated. Robert Kennedy was assassinated. Medgar Evers was assassinated. We had pipe bombs going off in the late 60s and the 70s. Machine guns with people being kidnapped in the streets and houses. And it was a difficult period. Streets on fire, Detroit, Los Angeles.
Not forgetting the Kent State killings.
Kent State killings, absolutely. I mean, I recently reread some history about the Boston Massacre and so forth. And it just hit me immediately. I mean, you know, troops firing on people who were demonstrating. It became folklore in American history about that period, but Kent State was similarly troops firing on students who were demonstrating, and a massive crowd, and accidental, not meant, I think it was just a terrible moment. But the bottom line is this. We had a president of the United States who lied to the American people. He said he was not a crook. He turned out to be a crook. And that president was impeached and resigned rather than face the trial in the Senate. So we had this period of assassinations, of demonstrations, of bombs, of riots, and ultimately a presidential transformation, and we wound up stronger. We made it through that, and our institutions proved their strength. I believe that about America today. We're going through a difficult period, but our institutions remain strong. And you have to look at the outcome of this election we just had in the midterms. We had 113 million people vote. We've never had even 100 million vote in midterms in the history of the nation. We had young people turn out 50%, 55% higher than ever before, coming up to 31% from 19%. It's not good enough yet, but it's better than it's ever been. We saw 7 governorships flip from Republican to Democrat, including Kansas and Wisconsin, which were Republican strongholds till now. Trump carried Wisconsin. We had 290 legislative seats around the country change hands. We had six legislatures become Democrat, switching from Republican. We see the largest class of new congressmen and women elected since the Watergate class of 1974. So really, this news has not yet been sort of fully digested by a lot of people. This was a very important midterm election, and our democracy worked. And so I think that the course correction we've been looking for may well have taken place, but that depends on the fight of the next 2 years. Now, we have to go out and be equally as attentive and even more energetic than we were this time.
Now, you have to have confidence, therefore, in your electoral system, that the machines work, that they can't be hacked. Even going back to paper, the hanging chads and all the rest of it that we remember from Florida with Al Gore. And the question is, how robust can it be? Logically, you'd be going high tech and trying to make sure that votes would be counted quickly and expeditiously, and you get the result that is fair and honest. The hacking, attempted hacking of U.S. elections, I mean, that's got to be a big worry.
It is a worry. I have, maybe I'm a throwback or something, but I'm for paper ballots. I believe even if you have electronic, you got to have a paper ballot backup. And that's doable, and it is done in a lot of states now. But I've had the privilege of being, as a senator, election observer in a number of different countries and recently. And I've seen paper ballots be counted remarkably fast and remarkably effectively with great oversight and transparency. So whatever happens, the United States clearly has some work to do to make sure our elections are absolutely perceived to be free and fair and accountable.
Now, what is remarkable, I suppose, that two people in the public domain should have been together in college. I'm thinking of you and Robert Mueller. You are well acquainted.
Well, we're well acquainted, not by college. Well, we knew each other in college, but he was at a different college. We actually competed against each other in sports at college. But prior to that, we spent 5 years in high school together, and we played on the same soccer, hockey, and lacrosse teams for all of those years. And I knew him, obviously, as a professional prosecutor. We had a number of occasions when we worked together on one or two things. He's a terrific, very, very capable prosecutor. You've noticed there hasn't been one single leak. I don't think anybody can tell you with certainty what's going on. He's a man of enormous integrity and courage, and I think he will do what's best for America, period, without regard to any party or any ideological input whatsoever.
Do you think he needs to be protected, that they need?
I do. Well, I think this battle over this is inappropriate, and it, in its own way, is a kind of obstruction on a daily basis. I think that it would be highly appropriate, given the appointment of a clearly not qualified and already biased person to serve as acting attorney general. It seems to me that it would be highly appropriate for the Congress to make it clear where the line is, simply not, you know, not to be crossed.
What is it about Donald Trump? I'm sure you've studied him at great length. You know, that he appoints someone in charge of science who doesn't believe in science, someone who he appoints to education who doesn't believe in public education, people who lack basic competences in areas. I mean, Rex Tillerson, for example, who became Secretary of State before being fired by Donald Trump, was a man with some international experience, but no diplomatic experience, simply business experience, and a man who, under pressure, I believe, refused to meet you to get briefed.
Well, let me just say, Pat, I'm not trying to avoid the reality of the question you asked, but I'm uncomfortable, you know, getting into personal discussion about the president while I'm overseas and talking about my book and so forth.
But just the generality, because normally competence is the first thing you look. You may not like somebody, but if they're competent, let's get that person to do the job.
Well, that's what it's all about. We'll have an election in 2 years. It will be highly contested, and the American people will have a chance to make their judgment.
Let's talk about the Iran deal and how tortuous the negotiations were and how emphatic a deal it was to get so many parties on board.
Well, I think in many ways, I think it speaks for itself, Pat. Thank you for bringing it up. But I think, you know, we set out as a matter of preventative nuclear policy to make certain that Iran was not on a pathway to develop a bomb, which they were before we sat down. The day I sat down with my counterpart in New York at the UN was the first time an American Secretary of State had met with the Iranian foreign minister in 40 years. And at that moment, Iran was 2 months away from breaking out to have a nuclear weapon. If they chose to break out, they would take them only 2 months. They had 12,000 kilograms of stockpiled enriched uranium. They had thousands of centrifuges spinning, enriching. They'd mastered the fuel cycle. Today, Iran is living under by choice, they agreed to live under the most rigid nuclear agreement on the planet, where there is great visibility. We have 130 additional inspectors. We have televised cameras in their production facilities. We measure every day what the levels of stockpile and uranium enrichment are, and so forth. And they are limited to a level of enrichment which makes it physically impossible to actually make a bomb. So, I mean, if you don't like the deal, the wiser thing, I think, to have done would have been to say to the French, Germans, British, Chinese, Russians, all of whom are staying in the deal, and Iran, to say, look, I don't like the deal, but we need to deal with these other issues, and if you'll deal with me on these other issues, then we'll stay in the deal. And I think you'd have had a far more compliant group of allies. And Iran would have said, okay, well, we'll negotiate. But doing what he's done by just pulling out, saying we're out of here, unilaterally putting all the sanctions back in place, you make it exceedingly difficult for your own allies to support you. And they're not right now. They're trying to keep the agreement, as is. But you also make it politically extremely difficult for any Iranian leader to come back to the table because of the politics of the hardliners in that country. So I think it's empowered the hardliners, and it puts the world at greater risk.
Do you understand, because I don't, why Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out? I mean, you can talk about Iran's meddling right across the Middle East and the presence of people who are armed and backed by Iran in various theatres of conflict. But, you know, that is not that strange or unusual. There are many actors who support people in foreign wars.
Well, certainly, obviously. But on the other hand, there are real issues with Iran's behavior. And I support the fact that we wanted to make we need to curb that. I mean, we don't like their support for Hezbollah. Hezbollah is a terrorist organization. We don't like it. Threatens Israel. Iran threatens Israel. We don't like their meddling in some of these other countries, the transfer of weapons against an embargo to Yemen. So there are legitimate issues that we wanted to raise, but we thought it was wiser to raise them without the prospect of a nuclear weapon potentially being on the table. And we didn't intend to give away any bargain, there wouldn't be any concession in the negotiations trading nuclear issues for those other issues. So the best way to protect what you needed to do on the nuclear was get the nuclear done, which is what we did, then go to the follow-on agreement. And I think they've made it difficult. Now, the rationale, you have to get them to answer it. I mean, I don't think they've adequately given in the world an answer, other than politics, other than it was the Obama administration and they opposed most things.
Well, you're
Obama.
Anticipating my next question. You know, NAFTA was, abandoned initially and then brought back with a little tweak and renamed something else because NAFTA was Obama.
Yeah, it's Obamacare. It's really not very different. It's just rebranded, basically.
It rebranded. And the same thing with Obamacare. I mean, he did try to replace it with something else, but it does seem that anything that has Obama's name attached to it, it has got to be upturned. The same with the Paris Climate Accord, although he is a climate change denier. I think you have to take a lot of credit for, if you like, the release of Obama onto the American political national stage.
Well, in the sense that I gave him an opportunity, obviously, with the speech. I asked him to be the keynoter at my convention in Boston and at the Democratic convention. And he did a brilliant job, as I knew he would. And that obviously put him on the scene. I kind of anticipated, Pat, you know, that he was going to renominate me as president 4 years later. I didn't think he was going to become my boss that quickly.
But you had a list of speakers, and you said this guy kind of jumped out of the list.
Well, he did to me, because I'd met him in Chicago. We were at an event together during my race, and I was impressed by him. And I had no doubt that he would do exactly what he did at the convention.
The failures, because there are always failures in every administration, how do you regard what happened with the use of chemical weapons in Syria and the red line that was crossed by Assad, and then he suffered no consequence?
Well, there's a great deal of misunderstanding about that flow of events. People say that President Obama, backed down on the promise that there would be a price paid. But the reason he didn't, the reason he delayed the bombing, he never decided that he wouldn't bomb. That's first of all. What he decided was, because David Cameron had gone to the parliament in Britain and lost, as a democratic country, an ally, it kind of put the Obama administration in a difficult place. Do you not go to Congress? Do you not seek their approval too? And the president knew what happens in wars. If you start bombing any place, it can lead to whatever, and you really want to make sure the Congress is with you. So the president took a moment to say, I'm going to go to Congress. And we all believed that Congress would quickly support him. In the meantime, in fact, in London, where I am now, I stood up at a press conference and I was asked the question, is there anything Assad could do to avoid being bombed? And I said, yes, he could get rid of all his chemical weapons, you know, now and quickly. And that is what happened. Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia, and I sat down in Geneva a week later, and we arrived at an agreement to get all the declared weapons out. So we knew there were some undeclared still held, but we got 1,300 tons of the worst chemical weapons out of Syria during the conflict. And for that effort, the OPCW that did the actual process of getting the weapons collected and out won the Nobel Peace Prize for that year. So it wasn't without consequence that what happened was the securing of 1,300 tons of weapons, which, by the way, if it hadn't happened, when ISIS, Daesh, started marauding across the countryside of Syria and into Iraq, guess what? Some of those weapons would have fallen into their hands. And then the subways of London or Paris or wherever, New York, might have been threatened much more seriously. So, you know, we got a lot more done than I think people realize, but we knew there were additional weapons. When he used those additional weapons later, I supported taking action against him. And I supported President Trump taking the retributive action against him. I would prefer to see it followed up immediately by real diplomacy that leverages that action in order to get a consequence. But nevertheless, I think Assad did have to pay a price on that. We had many a debate about it. And as I write in my book, I was not able to convince the president that it was worth taking the risk of doing what we needed to do in now, response to that.
You mentioned Sergei Lavrov and your contacts with the Russians. I mean, they seem to have pretty much a permanent government now headed by Putin. We saw his presidency followed by relegation to prime minister for a while, back to the presidency again. And you do have a consistency of foreign policy from the Russians under Putin. Where that will go when his time comes to shuffle off, we don't know. But is it a weakness in the American system that you do have a changing of the guard, perhaps every 4 years, but inevitably after 8 years, a total changing of the guard, often U-turns on policy?
Well, no, I don't think it's a weakness. I think it's a strength. I mean, it looks like a weakness today because of what we're going through. But I think the American political system is remarkably resilient, and that is one of its great virtues, that power is not allowed to corrupt completely over an inevitable amount of time. We change the guard, and that's a very healthy thing, that people get to go vote and fight over the direction of our nation. The problem has been not that we don't have a fight, just not enough people taking part in it, not enough people exercising their right to vote. When Trump was elected in 2016, there was only a 54.2% turnout of eligible voters in America. When Obama was elected, the turnout was 62.3% turnout. So you see the difference. We need to make it easier for people to vote in America. And we need to make it far more of an imperative that everybody exercise their rights as a citizen and does vote.
I should ask you about Putin and whether or not the West, if you like, provoked Russia when it was on its knees economically by pushing NATO further to the east and literally camping on Russia's sphere of influence, on its doorstep. Was that a mistake? Is that what created the Putin we have today, or was Putin always going to be Putin?
Well, that's far more complicated than I can answer in a few minutes on the show with you, Pat. But let me just say this. First of all, there are really legitimate complaints against some of Putin's choices and activities of Russia today with respect to its involvement, not just in our elections, but in the political systems of other countries. It's dangerous what's happening right now. I think what happened in Ukraine was the only major example of any nation crossing international boundaries to take land and annex it and be disruptive within another nation with force of arms. That broke all the norms of what we've been working to achieve ever since World War II. So I think that there have been legitimate challenges we've had to deal with. Now, every leader, every country in the world has its priorities and has its defined security interests. Clearly, Putin objected to the expansion of NATO, no question about it. And clearly, he objected to the movement of the ballistic missile defense systems into areas proximate to Russia, because that affects their perception of safety and their own deterrent capacity. Clearly, he objected to the resolution that was passed in the Security Council regarding Libya, where he voted for it with certain assurances, and he felt those assurances were broken when Gaddafi was regime changed. So I think, you know, there are a set of things that he will find to express that he objected to, and you have to try to have a dialogue about those things. But none of those things excuse the other behavior that's been taking place. What we need is a very legitimate engagement. We need to be strong and tough, but at the same time, we need to recognize that wars are the failure of diplomacy. And if you want to avoid conflict in the future, you've got to talk to each other. You've got to work together to work out those issues. I believe in engaged diplomacy, and I believe, above all, greatly reinforced by my own experience in Vietnam, in a war in which we were lied to, I believe that it is imperative that you exhaust the remedies of diplomacy before you send young men and women of any country off to fight and die.
Yeah, it's always old men send young men in to die, isn't that? The armchair generals.
There's a lot of poetry about that.
Yeah. John, I suppose finally I should ask you, we don't have time to go into your contact with the Kennedys. That's all to be found within the covers of your book, so people can enjoy that.
Well, it is. There's a wonderful picture of me sailing there. But just suffice it to say, Teddy Kennedy was my colleague for 26 years in the United States Senate. And I worked for him as an 18-year-old when I did meet President Kennedy. And I was involved in his very first campaign when he ran for the Senate in 1962. So they're a great family. They all contribute one way or the other to public life. They all take great risks, and they love their Irish heritage, obviously. Yeah.
So the last question really is, given Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, age is no barrier to seeking the highest political office in the land. Are you going to give it a go again?
Yeah. Pat, you expected me to come on here. I'm in London. You're in Ireland. I'm going to announce something. Yes.
Are you ruling it out?
I've said I wouldn't rule it out, and I'm going to think about it. I'm going to think about it.
Well, our listeners, I think, would give you their votes if you put your name in the hat. But John, thank you very much for joining us from London. The book is out now. It's called Every Day is Extra. It's published by Simon & Schuster in hardback and complete with loads of great pictures as well. John Kerry, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.